This week's parasha is Parashas Achrei Mos Kedeshim, and we'll actually go out of order, and we'll start in Parashas Kedeshim on page 664.
What page?
664. Pasuk Chavches, second line from the top. V'seret l'nevesh l'sitne b'psarchem. You shall not make a cut in your flesh for a soul, meaning it's a prohibition. There was a practice that when a person would lose a loved one, as a sign of mourning, they would cut themselves. So that is the first part of the pasuk. It forbids a person to do so. U'cheseves kaka, which is translated as, cheseves kaka means a writing of kaka, of incision in the body, v'yisitnu b'achem, you shall not put in yourselves, ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Now, chseves kaka, a writing of incision, is another word for tattoo. This is the Torah's prohibition of having a tattoo. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this prohibition of a tattoo. And what I'm going to share with you comes from an article written by Rabbi Yehuda Spitz of Ar Sameach in Yerushalayim. Now, when we talk about the prohibition of a tattoo, the Gemara tells us that there are two steps to a tattoo. There are two steps for this prohibition. The first step is that the skin has to be perforated. Okay? You're going into the skin. And then the hole or holes that you're made are filled with ink or whatever other pigmentation, causing a mark to be there and to be permanent. So if you just go ahead and, let's say, make a perforation, right? And through perforation you spell out something, right? That's not a ksevis kaka, that's not a tattoo. Let's say, the fake tattoos, right? The piece of paper and you wet it and you stuck it on your hand and off came a picture, okay? That's not a tattoo because that doesn't go into the skin. In order to this prohibition of a tattoo is where, again, you perforate, you make a perforation in the skin, and then you fill in that perforation with the ink, causing this mark to remain. Now, the Sefer HaKinuch, the Book of Mitzvot, that this gives us the background, the reasons for mitzvot, explains that the reason for this prohibition of a tattoo is because it's part of how the Torah is trying to distance us from all forms of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship. It was a common practice for idol worshippers to basically brand themselves. They branded themselves to the idol or to the pagan god that they worshipped. And they used to basically make a tattoo in which they would make some kind of a mark, a branding in themselves that says they are, so to speak, they belong, and they are completely given over to this idol. And the same way an animal is branded, they would brand themselves as a sign of totally belonging and worshiping this idol. And therefore, being that this was a form of, it was part of idol worship, and the Torah always wants us to distance ourselves from idol worship completely, therefore the Torah forbids us to make to have a tattoo. Now, once there's a prohibition of having a tattoo, I mean, if you put the tattoo on yourself, you make the tattoo on yourself, that would be an act of putting a tattoo in yourself, and actually you would carry a punishment of malchus of lashes. If somebody else does it to you, so again, it's a prohibition for you to allow a tattoo to be put in you, but if you didn't do it, you're not going to get lashes, because any prohibition that doesn't have an act involved doesn't have lashes. But again, it's a prohibition whether to have the tattoo itself, to allow yourself to have a tattoo be put into you, that is a prohibition. At the same time, once you have a tattoo, there is no obligation to remove it. Okay? The prohibition of chseves kakalei sitnu bachem, don't put the tattoo in you, But once you have it, there's no obligation to remove it. And very interestingly, there was a Rav during the Holocaust, Rav Chaim Oshri, was himself a Holocaust survivor, and he actually published a number of responses that he wrote, or he wrote a number of the halakhic questions that were put to him during the war, and he wrote that Holocaust survivors should not remove their tattoos, or that they should wear it as a badge of honor. So there's no prohibition of taking it off. And he actually held that, Rabbi Chaim Oshri held that those people who were tattooed during the war, they should keep those tattoos on themselves as a badge of honor. Now, the thing is like this. What's interesting is that the process of removing a tattoo is not a very simple process, right? Not a very simple process. And actually, removing a tattoo could actually run into a prohibition. There's a prohibition for a person to inflict a wound upon themselves, right? To inflict a wound in yourself, forget about inflicting a wound for over somebody who as a sign of mourning. The idea of inflicting damage in yourself, physical damage in yourself, is a rabbinic prohibition. And therefore, you know, the whole idea of actually removing a tattoo may be problematic. Now, it seems that there are discussions in halacha about the permissibility of various options of tattoo removal. But since this, if there's going to be any problem with tattoo removal, it's going to be what we say, it's a prohibition of damaging yourself. That prohibition is not a d'oraisa, it's not a Torah prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition. And therefore, because it's a rabbinic prohibition, we have a rule. The Gemara tells us that one is permitted to do what would typically be a rabbinic prohibition for what's called kavod abrius, to preserve human dignity. To preserve human dignity, you could actually transgress, or you could actually do what would typically be a rabbinic prohibition. And therefore, if the reason why you are removing this tattoo is because of embarrassment, right, it doesn't look good for you, that's called preserving your dignity. It's embarrassing to you. It makes you look bad. If the reason why you would be removing this tattoo is for kavod abrius, because of embarrassment, that would be a reason that would allow you to do it, even if it would be considered a rabbinic prohibition. Even removing that tattoo is considered inflicting damage upon yourself, being that it's rabbinic prohibition and you're doing it for kavod abrius, you're doing it because of your dignity, because you're embarrassed of it, then it would be permissible to remove the tattoo. Okay. Now, I think it's important right now to mention something very important. You know, have you ever heard people say that if you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery? Have you heard of that?
Sure. Yeah.
You never heard of that?
Sure.
I only heard of it like after I became a Rav in Malden and somebody mentioned it to me. I'd never heard of it in my life. But like, it was, yeah, sure, if you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
It's a Boston thing.
Baloney. What?
It's a Boston thing.
It's a Boston thing? Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah,
but at the just to know, right,
yeah.
It's a myth. It's not true. Rabbi Spitz writes, interestingly, he says that possibly the origin of this myth were Jewish bubbies who wanted to ensure that their grandchildren didn't stray too far from the proper path. So they made up this thing, oh, you're going to put on a tattoo, you can't go to a Jewish cemetery. Oh, okay, bubby, I'm not going to do that. But it's a myth. There is no such thing. There's no such thing that because you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. So I wanted to get that out of the way right away in case there was something on your mind.
Rabbi Katz on Sunday spoke about tattoos at the young Israel.
Oh, really?
He talked about years ago, they had a piece of the skin or whatever, they would take out of another skin too, but now he says...
Let me talk about that. The pigmentation, the permanent makeup?
But they said they could do a tattoo, but if you're a Jewish, you should have a non-Jew do it for the patient, not you, as a doctor.
What's the case?
I guess they're able to do something without putting skin. It's like a tattoo. They're making the right color or something.
Well, we always talk about something like that, because actually, yeah.
There's been a couple of years ago, there's a lot of stories in Israel and Eretz Israel. The grandchildren of the Holocaust survivors would tattoo the grandparents' numbers on their arms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. There's no heter for that.
To keep the memory, if you will.
Yeah, there's no heter for that.
Okay.
It's really, I can't imagine that. There's no heter for that. I mean, we'll see. We'll talk a little bit about certain possibilities, but that I don't think that case. Well, after we discuss it, we'll see. We'll come back to it. That's very interesting, but I don't see it. I don't think it could work. It's interesting. I one time was in the Malden post office, and I see this guy, and he's got the words Zachar tattooed in his arm.
In Hebrew.
And did you ask?
I was very taken back. I just wasn't sure what to do, you know. But it was interesting. But you know, people do a lot of things with tattoos, you know. But I don't think that would be something you'd be allowed to do.
The worst one I know is my friend has Yud Kei Vav Kei Amin.
Oh, well, like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Back left shoulder blade.
Wow. Okay.
Shmar
in the front. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Now, this discussion that I'm telling you from Rabbi Yehuda Spitz actually revolves around the issue of micropigmentation, or what's called permanent makeup. You know, there are people who want to always have that, you know, just made up look. They don't have to bother putting on makeup every single day. And therefore, basically, there's a color pigmentation that's injected into the skin, around the lips, around the eyes. And you've always got that made-up look, that freshly made-up look. And it lasts for 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years. But it works the same way as a tattoo. So, you know, he has a discussion, is it permissible to do? So to answer this question, you have to cite a number of discussions that revolved around this prohibition of having a tattoo. So the Torah refers to the tattoo as we read as kaseves kaka, writing incisions. Okay? The writing of incisions. So there is a machlekes amongst halachic authorities that because the Torah described this tattoo as kaseves kaka, writing incisions, but use the word writing, there's a machlekes rishonim if the Torah prohibition of tattoos is only with a letter. Because it says ksevis. That's interesting. In other places we have ksevis, we have the word ksiva writing, which doesn't only mean a letter. It means at least a symbol, something. And you maybe even a picture on Shabbos, right? There's an iser ksiva, the permission of writing, even if you didn't make a picture. So I don't know what exactly, but the way he brings it down is a machlekes amongst the halachic authorities of the Torah prohibition is only when you at least make one letter. That lies in the fact that the Torah called it ksiva. So it's a machlekes if you need writing for the Torah prohibition. But everybody agrees that the rabbinic prohibition, any tattoo, right? Those, you know, whatever they have, those, you know, could probably be in Chinese also, right? They have the Chinese guys, Chinese tattoos and stuff like that. But that's a letter. But I'm saying that the machlekes whether the Torah prohibition is only when you write a letter. It's a machlekes, an argument, but all agree that even if it's not a letter, any tattoo is at least forbidden midrabbanan according to rabbinic law.
Well, the thing is also if they're saying it has to be a letter, then technically the artist could still do a, you know, design of the letter almost and still scribble over it. So it'd be almost as if they are still writing a letter no matter what.
Well,
and also depending on the way that they're shaped.
Yeah, again, but let's say you don't. Let's say make a squiggly something, right? And it's not a letter.
Well, people do pictures.
Yeah. Pictures. Again, I find that interesting, but because like I say, I haven't got into this at full length, but Rabbi Spitz brings down that they say it has to be a letter.
But is it done because of health reasons?
Right now, let's just talk about a general discussion about tattoos, okay? Right now. There's one question if the Torah prohibition is only for a letter, but a carbonic prohibition, there's no question that you're doing it, that there's a carbonic prohibition, any kind of tattoo. There's another machlekes, another argument about the Torah prohibition of a tattoo. Typically a tattoo is permanent, right? You have a tattoo, it stays with you for your whole life. Well, what if it's a kind of tattoo, like this actual, you know, permanent makeup? It's not permanent. It doesn't last forever. There's a point of time that it does fade and go away, apparently. So, is permanency, right, a condition for the Torah prohibition? That's also an argument. But again, a rabbinic prohibition, it surely has. And there's another argument amongst the Paiskim, amongst the halachic authorities, that if, let's say, you're not doing it, we mentioned that the Chinuch says, Sefer Chinuch says, that the reason why the Torah prohibited it was because it was an act of idol worship. Okay, but let's say you don't do it for idol worship. You cause cool. Okay? Is that the Torah prohibition or not? Is that included in the Torah prohibition or not? That too is an argument amongst halachic authorities if the Torah prohibition includes even doing it not for idolatrous purposes. But again, from the point of a Issa d'Rabbanan, there definitely is. So as we say, getting inked, right, is going to be an Issa d'Rabbanan. Now, the thing is like this, though. The thing is that the permanent makeup, okay, let's think now, why does a person do the permanent makeup? So it's cosmetic, okay? So if it's cosmetic, it would seem that in the very least, right, in the very least, you have a rabbinic prohibition. At least a rabbinic prohibition, right? Even if you'll say all the things we said, not for idolatrous purposes, and when it's not permanent, and you didn't write a letter, right? There's no letters there. You're just, you know, making eyeliner and lipstick, whatever it is, okay? There's no letter there, okay? But at least a rabbinic prohibition is going to be. So therefore, it would seem that this permanent makeup should be forbidden midrabbanan. But as Barry just pointed out, there's more than one reason why a person could do this. You could be doing this just for beauty purposes, okay? You don't want to have to patch go with makeup, so we'll just always look, we'll have permanent makeup. Or sometimes it's for taking care, removing a scar, or any other kind of blemish, right? The reason you're doing it is because you have some kind of a damage, some kind of a scar, some kind of a blemish. And now you're going to basically cover it over with this permanent makeup, right? With this micropigmentation. In that situation, most contemporary places can say that you would be allowed to do, because that falls into the category of kavod abrius. According to most paiskim, most rishonim, cosmetic tattooing is a rabbanan. Okay, it's a rabbinic prohibition. If it's a rabbinic prohibition, as we said, for kavod abrius, to preserve human dignity, to deal with embarrassment or feeling bad about the way dealing with embarrassment or dealing with a blemish that makes you uncomfortable, that's called kavod abrius. That's called preserving human dignity. And where there's a question of a rabbinic prohibition or that, you're permitted to do what would typically be a rabbinic prohibition to preserve human dignity. So if you're only doing it for cosmetic in the sense of beauty, okay, so the vast majority of contemporary places can say you're not permitted to do it. If it's for, again, for purposes of removing a scar, correcting a blemish, then it falls under kavod abrius and it would be permissible to do. Similarly, we find cosmetic corrective surgery. Right? Cosmetic corrective surgery. You're going to go through surgery. You know, surgery is inflicting a wound upon yourself. You can't just do surgery for the fun of it. It has to be there has to be a purpose for it. So again, if a person is having cosmetic surgery, again, because of some kind of a blemish, some kind of a scar, some kind of a facial problem, okay, that falls under kavod abrius for the honor of the person. The person's embarrassed. This for the purpose of preserving the person's dignity. It's permissible to do. The same thing here with this permanent makeup. The permanent makeup is being done for the purpose of kavod abrius, to remove a scar, to correct a blemish. That according to the vast majority of contemporary paiskim, is permissible to do. It's for just for purely cosmetic purposes. According to the vast majority of contemporary paiskim, that would not be permissible to do. So again, this is a discussion. If it ever comes up halachically, of course, you make sure to ask a shaila.
So the other one is actually, because I'm working at Dana-Farber, there are people who have cancer that need to have dots or dye put on a certain part of the skin so that the technician knows to shoot the certain alpha beams, beta beams at it, at that certain part. So I have a friend who, thank God, he's...
Is that a tattoo?
Tattooed.
It's tattooed?
It is. So one of my friends, thank God, he's now recovered from cancer, but, you know, young guy was 19 years old when he was diagnosed. He had you know, he asked his rebbeim, you know, can I, and this is what I have to get done. They said it has to,
of course, it's very, right. Meaning, actually, the Gemara has a case of something that is very much like a tattoo, but it was being put in for medicinal purposes.
Right.
So for medicinal purposes is another reason. But makim chaylev, for medicinal purposes, that's another reason why something that would only be, maybe in this case it's even, you know, it could even override a deraisa. I mean, it's pekuach nefesh, you know, to treat a person for cancer. But clearly for medicinal purposes, something that would only be prohibited midrabanan would be permissible to do. Okay, so Ajay was just a little, you know, a lot of discussion about tattoos with a little bit of interesting details about this prohibition. Okay. Next thing I want to do is we're going to turn back a few pages. Back to page 660. Page 660, this is three lines from the bottom, Pasuk Yud-Zayin. Leisisna sachicha belvavecha, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. Hoicheach techiach asamisecha, you shall surely rebuke your friend. Leisisa alav chait, but you shall not bear a sin over him, because of him. These last words, Leisisa alav chait, you shall not carry over him a sin. Rashi explains, what does that mean? So Rashi says, this is Rashi in the column to the left, 2, 4, 6, 8, like 9 lines from the bottom, Pasuk Yud-Zayin, Vasisa Lav Chait, you shall not carry on him or because of him a sin. What does that mean? Leisilbet, Leisalbin as Panavarabim, do not embarrass him publicly. Meaning, that even though you have a mitzvah to rebuke him, okay, rebuking, which is a mitzvah, possibly if you do your rebuke wrong, you'll be getting a sin for it. If you embarrass him while you're rebuking him, you'll be committing a sin while you're actually trying to do a mitzvah. So the Torah says, you shall rebuke your friend, but don't bear a sin because of him. Meaning, don't do it in a way that you embarrass him, which actually will now be a sin on your part.
You should do it privately, I guess.
Do it privately, correct. Now, these words, Leisisa Lav Chait, my friend brings down from Bagdal Yeshur, call it a homiletical interpretation, where he takes the words literally, or he actually, especially literally, he uses the words a little bit differently. The word Sisa, which we say means to bear, means to carry. Sisa could also mean to lift up, right? To lift up. So Leisisa Lav Chait, don't lift, Leisisa, don't lift up a love over the person hate the sin. What does that mean, don't lift the sin over him? It means don't make the sin greater than the person. Don't minimize the person because of the sin. How, you know, you did such a horrible thing, right? That's basically maximizing the sin and minimizing the person. On the contrary, don't lift the sin over him. Don't make the sin bigger than him. Rather, actually make him bigger than the sin. In which you say to the person, how could a person like you do that? In which you really build up the person, and you say to the person, because of who you are, you're so great, you're so special, you are such a unique person, how do you do such a thing? So instead of lifting the sin, raising the sin over the person, which means you make the sin greater and minimize the person, on the contrary, do the other way around. Not to minimize the sin, but to actually rebuke him in a way that you lift him up. And you basically say, someone like him, how can you do such a thing? No, it's basically really, the best way of giving rebuke is to really not to put down the person in the sense of, you know, look, you did such a horrible thing, right? Like, you're such a, like we say, don't say to a kid, you're a bad boy, right? How could a good boy like you do that, right? In which you're actually trying to tell the person, you are special, you have greatness, and therefore this is not becoming of the kind of good person who you really are. And really, when it comes to rebuking, rebuking is an art. You know, whether we're a parent, whether we're a teacher, any kind of leadership position, when you have to rebuke someone, you know, it's not a simple thing. A person has to be very smart in the way they do the rebuke. Typically, putting down a person is not the way to go. But the question is, what is the way to rebuke? And Refrain brings down a beautiful story with the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim here, the way he rebuked this student, again, it was something probably very unique to the Chafetz Chaim. But it's another example of which how rebuke works without putting the person down. So the Chafetz Chaim, as we know, had his yeshiva in Raden, in Europe. And, you know, there was a period of time in the yeshivas in Europe, you know, around World War time and between the First War and the Second War, where there were a lot of winds blowing in the air, a lot of different influences that were all competing for the minds of the youth. And even you had yeshiva students that were in the yeshivas that were influenced by some of the different influences, negative secular influences that were promising every Jew that you'll get out of your poverty and you'll have a good life if you're a communist or a socialist or whatever you are, or you're a secularist, you'll become enlightened, your whole life will change. And even those who were seemingly within the walls of the yeshiva and within the walls of a Torah atmosphere, many of them were influenced and were not behaving in the proper way. There was more than one story of catching a yeshiva student on Shabbos smoking. There's a story in every European yeshiva like that. There were stories in that. And it seems that there was this bacher, the student in the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva, was caught smoking on Shabbos. And he was told that the Chafetz Chaim wanted to speak to him. Now, I have to back up. It's a story within a story. The story really starts with a rabbi who was invited to a community to speak, and he chose to speak about this topic of the mitzvah of giving rebuke. He's giving a whole lecture about this mitzvah. And at the conclusion of his lecture, he tells this story about the bacher. He says, I've heard this story, I don't know it firsthand, but I've heard this story many times. There was a bacher who was caught smoking on Shabbos in the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva, and he was summoned to the Chafetz Chaim. And as the boy walked in, you know, he walked into the room, but the Chafetz Chaim wanted to meet him. The boy was in there for no more than 2 minutes. And when he walked out, he became a Shabbos observer for the rest of his life. That's the story. And the rabbi said, you know, if only you would know what the Chafetz Chaim said. If we only would know what the Chafetz Chaim said to this young boy, it could actually be a tremendous lesson for us to be able to know how to rebuke properly. But we don't know what the Chafetz Chaim said to this young man. Again, smoking on Shabbos, he was in there for a grand total of 2 minutes, and he came out a completely changed person. We don't know what the Chafetz Chaim said. All we can do is do our best. After the lecture is over, a man walks up to him, crying, and he says, I know what the Chafetz Chaim said, because I was that boy. So the rabbi, you know, gently asked him, what did the Chafetz Chaim say to you? So he said that before I entered the Chafetz Chaim's office, I was terrified. I didn't know what he was going to say, what he was going to do. And I walk into the room, and I see the Chafetz Chaim, and he's got this painful expression of pain on his face. The Chafetz Chaim walked up to him. The Chafetz Chaim is a very short man. He says, Chafetz Chaim, come up to his chest. And the Chafetz Chaim took his hand and he looked at him and he just said, Shabbos. And he cried. And a minute later, he picks up his head, he looks at the boy, he looks at me, the man said, and again, he says, Shabbos. And I feel as hot tears coming down on my hand. I saw the pain of the Chafetz Chaim's face, and that was enough to change me, and from then on, I was completely Shemesh Shabbos. So the secret to the Chavetz Chaim's Teichacha, the Chavetz Chaim's rebuke was, again, didn't put the boy down. He actually didn't bring the boy up either. What he did was he sincerely expressed his pain over the Chil Shabbos, over the desecration of Shabbos. The desecration of Shabbos of the Chavetz Chaim was as if we were to be standing in shul, right? And somebody were to open up the Arun, and out would fall a Sefer Torah. All the Sefer Torahs in the Arun would come crashing down on the floor. Right? To us, that would be painful. We would all feel the pain of all those Torahs falling down. To the Chavetz Chaim, when the Chavetz Chaim heard someone desecrated Shabbos, him, that was painful. It hurt him. And when this boy saw the sincere pain of the Chavetz Chaim, that was what changed him. So, rebuke works in many, many different, can work in many different ways. And sometimes it takes you have to be an artist. Not that the Chavetz Chaim was doing this in a way of trying to, in any skillful manner. He was expressing his sincere pain. But you see that when it comes to the kind of rebuke that really leaves its mark, it's not necessarily the one that you bash the person over the head, but it's the one in which either you either build them up and show them and say to them, you know, how could someone like you do this? Or in the case of the Chavetz Chaim, the Bachar understood what he had done when he saw the pain of the Chavetz Chaim's face. Okay. The next thing I want to talk about, working backwards, back in the parish of Achrimais. And this is on page 654. This is Pasuk Lamed, last Pasuk in the parasha. Ushmartem es mishmarti, which is translated as you shall safeguard my charge. So as not to do any of these abominations that were done before you. You shall not become impurified through them. I'm Hashem your God. From these words at the beginning of the Pasuk, Ushmartem es mishmarti, you shall safeguard my charge, you shall safeguard my guarding. The Gemara says, we derive from here that the sages were given the power that the Torah has guarded us from doing certain things, and we are to make a guard to that. We're to make a safeguard to that. The Torah tells us, keeps us away from certain things, and now the Torah now charges the sages to actually institute laws as fences, as precautionary measures, not to come and stumble into that which the Torah forbade. So the Torah has its mishmeres. The Torah has creates its guard, meaning it says, stay away from these things, right? Forbidden marriages, whatever it may be. The Torah guards us from these things by telling us, don't do it. And we are told to make a guard to the guard, to make a fence to what we're supposed to guard ourselves from. Make a precautionary fence for what you need to guard yourselves from. Torah tells us, guard yourself from this prohibition, and our sages are told that they have the power to institute a fence, a guard, to what we're supposed to guard ourselves from. And this is the source for the power of our sages to institute rabbinic law, which are fences, precautionary measures, to make sure that we don't come to sin. Now, rabbinic prohibitions are something that many people find very annoying, because very restrictive. Isn't it enough what the Torah said we shouldn't do? You got to make it harder for us? And unfortunately, what people like that are missing is the fact that, you know, when you have a fire, you're making a bonfire, right? And you want all the little kids to stay away. You don't just say, don't touch the fire, right? You say, stay 10 feet away from the fire, right? Because if you get too close to the fire, you don't realize how close you are, and you get burned. The same thing, the sages went and made precautionary measures, they made fences for us to make sure that we don't get too close to the fire of sin because we could get burned. And these precautionary measures actually manifest themselves in different ways, in the sense that It's always creating a precautionary measure. It's creating a fence not to come to do a sin. But they work on different levels. So, for instance, we know on Shabbos, the sages instituted, there are certain things we cannot move. Because if you move them, you may come to use them on Shabbos, and it's forbidden for you to use them on Shabbos. There are certain times that the sages realized that we may forget, and not necessarily intentionally do something wrong, but accidentally, unintentionally do something wrong. An unintentional sin we know is a sin, right? A carbon chatas, a sin offering, is brought for an unintentional sin. An unintentional sin also needs an atonement. The sages said, created certain measures. They saw at a certain point of time that people were stumbling too often, and therefore they created fences, precautionary measures, not to come to that. So they tell us, don't handle, if you have an object that its main purpose is forbidden, its main usage is forbidden on Shabbos, don't move it, because if you start handling it, you may forget yourself and use it on Shabbos. And these are the kinds of rabbinic prohibitions that we say to ourselves, okay, I get that one. I get that. You know, it makes a lot of sense. If I'm going ahead and I'm handling something that I could come to use in a forbidden manner, so don't touch it. Don't go near it. Okay. It could be a little bit annoying to some people, but at the end of the day, we appreciate what the sages are trying to do. But at the same time, we then have situations where some of the rabbinic prohibitions that they institute seem a bit far-fetched. Okay, so for instance, okay, we have a prohibition of let's say pas akum, right? If a guy bakes bread, let's just keep it simple, he bakes it in his house, right? He bakes it in his house. Even if you know the ingredients, you were the mashgiach there, you saw all the ingredients were kosher, but you had no involvement in the process of baking whatsoever. He did the entire process of baking. The rabbis of sages said, you cannot eat that bread. If a guy touches wine, right? He didn't pour the wine as a libation to any kind of, for pagan worship, but he touched the wine, he made the wine, or he just touched the wine. Again, we can't drink the wine. Why did the sages do that? The sages went in and prohibited these foods of a non-Jew, even though they may be completely kosher, mishum chasus, to prevent intermarriage. Prevent intermarriage. Now, okay, if the prohibition said that a guy comes and invites you to his house, and he invites you to have a meal with him, that's forbidden to do, then we say, all right, I can understand that that's prohibited, because if I start frequenting his house, right, I may marry his daughter. Okay, but we know, right, that the prohibition is not only in that situation. And we can say that the majority of situations where the sages prohibit you to eat the bread of a guy, the wine of a guy, you know, it could very well be that, you know, you're having no social interaction with him whatsoever, okay? It's wine in the store, right? It's wine in the store. He touched the wine, but you know he didn't do anything wrong with the wine. It's still prohibited. So you're telling me even that wine I can't drink because somehow or another I'll come to marry a non-Jewish woman? It seems a bit far-fetched. We know that the sages instituted that if a man's wife is Anida, she is forbidden to him. So of course we know, we can understand, certain things don't do, right? But we know that the sages instituted, the Chachamim said, that if your wife is forbidden to you, you can't pass something to her. You can't pass something to her. She can't pass something to you. You can't pass something to her. You can't even throw it. Why? So, why? It would seem like, well, we're afraid if you do that, all of a sudden, you know, we're afraid if you do that, you're going to come and be intimate and you're going to transgress the Torah prohibition. So by just going in and handing her something, that's going to bring me to do an actual sin? Is that how far we're going? And the answer is, that there are certain rabbinic prohibitions that the point of the prohibition was to create an atmosphere of separation. It's not that we have a situation where this act will directly lead to your sin. In certain cases, we understand. If you handle something on Shabbos that you're not supposed to, that you can't use, and you handle it, okay, there's a good, there we understand very well the closeness between the usage and the handling it, right? But then there are times that we don't have such a direct connection from the prohibited act to what we're concerned about. But the point is to create an atmosphere. If we cannot eat the bread of a guy or drink his wine, right, that makes it very clear to us that we have to be separated. And if we live our lives in a way that we know we have to be separated, then that is the way that that prevents intermarriage. It's not just a question of preventing intermarriage by saying, you know, don't eat a meal in his house. But the Chachamim understood that we have to create an atmosphere of separation. And you create that atmosphere of separation by creating separation in things, right, that again, eating, drinking, right, these are things that bring closest to people. But if we say absolutely no partaking of their food and no partaking of their wine, then that again makes it very clear to us the idea of being separate. It creates an atmosphere, an attitude of separation. And that's the attitude and atmosphere that we need to prevent intermarriage. The same thing when it comes to these prohibitions when a man's wife is Anita. Because you're going to hand her something, does that mean all of a sudden you're going to get aroused and all of a sudden do something you're not supposed to do? No. But again, if I can hand something to her, there's connection. If I can't, there's separation. And in these situations, it's important to have an atmosphere of separation. And therefore, we shouldn't see this rabbinic decree as something far-fetched because I do this, this is going to happen? No. Maybe it won't happen. But the point is, though, that the sages understood that through these things, an atmosphere of separation will be created, which will then prevent a person from coming to sin because there is this attitude, an atmosphere of separation. Because if you let things get too close, that's when you have trouble, right? This is why the sages instituted what we call the Isser of Yichud. Yichud, being in privacy with a woman, okay, right? The biggest problems in society come about, right, because everybody can be as close as they want, right? If an Isser Yichud would be more prevalent, there'd be a lot less problems in the world. But society doesn't want to be restricted. And society talks it into themselves, the Yitzhara talks it into people to say, I wouldn't do that. That's not going to be a problem. I can control myself. I'm a civilized person. I can be in control of myself. And therefore, you talk it into yourself that you can, you know, you can push the envelope, you can get as close as you want. Oh, I won't do anything wrong. Right? Or on the contrary, you know, we all have to be in control, and no matter how I present myself, you have to be in control. Or no matter what situation we put ourselves into, we have to be in control. The sages understood that's not how things work. That's not reality. That's fooling ourselves. And if we don't open our eyes, we don't have to open our eyes, we can, you know, there's enough stories around that we hear that it doesn't take much to see that if people would understand what yichud is about, what not being in seclusion, what not being together is about, they'd understand, they'd give them a chance to see that, they would realize and take it serious, they would realize that it's there because we're not as perfect as we think we are. We're not in control as much we think we are. And in general, you know, there is this idea in, you know, I just read, Rabbi Leff brings down this story about a student in the yeshiva of Eliel Lapian Zatzal who asked permission to go to a family wedding. And Rabbi Lapian Zatzal said to the young boy, are there going to be any women there that are going to be dressed immodestly? So the boy said, nothing to worry about. I'm beyond that. I've come to the level, I see these things, they don't bother me. So Rabbi Lapian said to him, okay, you can go to the wedding. Before you go to the wedding, I'm going to give you a phone number. It's a friend of mine. Call him up. Okay, the boy goes and calls up the number, and he comes back to Rabbi Lapian and he says, must have been a mistake. It was a doctor's office. So it was a doctor's office. So Rabbi Lapian said, no, that was the right number. He said, I'm a man over 80 years old. I'm blind in one eye. And these things still affect me. If you're telling me it doesn't affect you, you need a doctor. You need a doctor. Now, in society, right, there are certain things that are taboo, and there are certain things that, it's okay, it's eye candy. It's all right, it's just eye candy. Those things are all right, right? And, you know, and if those things are all right, you know, so, okay, so, no, those things are okay. I don't have to worry about those things. Those kinds of things are, it's just, you know, It's just, you know, fun, right? But going to do other things, that, I'm never going to do that, okay? Even if that would be true, even if that would be true, the Torah teaches us that a person's focus has to be in the right things. And when you allow your mind and your focus to be involved in certain things that are very mundane, you're a different person. Forget about what it could lead you to. You're a different person. The person who understands how much in halacha it talks about creating fences from these kinds of enticing things. Forget about the prohibition. And even forget about touching. But the idea of what we're permitted to look at and not permitted to look at. This is all about making us into godly people. Because even if you don't do something wrong, but what your essence is about, what you allow into your mind, what your essence is into, what you put your energy into, what is it that's preoccupying you? And even if it's not preoccupying, you're not a whole day, okay? But this is where you're drawn to. You're a different person. We are supposed to be involved in godliness. We're supposed to make ourselves like Hashem as much as possible. And therefore, there are certain things that even if we're not going to do a prohibited act, we don't do them because of what the kind of person we're supposed to be. And this is all part, again, this is something that society doesn't want to listen to because it wants to be free to do what it wants, and it talks it into itself, there won't be anything wrong, there won't be any problems from it. But in essence, this is what destroys society. The sages understood, as holy as they were, and seemingly out of the real world that they were, they understood human frailty better than any of us. And because they understood the frailty of a human being, they created these gezeiros, these decrees, that are not meant to be restrictive and controlling, but rather meant to be protective measures for our good. It's meant to keep us away from direct connection to doing something wrong. This could very well lead to this, such as muktzah, such as yichud. These are things that, these prohibitions have direct connections, that if we don't keep them, these acts have direct connections to coming to sin. And then there are the decrees in which the sages said we need to create an atmosphere. And by having that atmosphere, that attitude, that is what will keep us away from sin. So it's not about being restrictive, it's not about being controlling. It's about keeping us away from getting burned.